Testing, okay. So we're continuing where we left off yesterday. And first we will have the usual preliminary homage. So if you want to stay at the top, if you want to do this with me, this is traditional. Means of paying respect to what we're about to study so that we take it seriously. It shouldn't be a game or a joke. This is something profound and important to us. So we set our minds in a respectful state. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadin Svākato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasam. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka sangho sanghang namam. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay. So, and we get started with the study course. We are halfway down the document, so if you're still at the top, start scrolling until you get to the orange. We are here, it's just a little over halfway down the length of the document. So we'd actually started into the second part of the sutta, which is where the Buddha begins to explain how the simile of the elephant footprint is properly told, because he's been given the simile of the elephant footprint according to the wanderer. Whose name was? Anyone remember the wanderer's name? Pilotika. Pilotika gave this simile to the Brahmin Janusoni. And then Brahman Janusoni came and told the Buddha, and the Buddha said, this isn't how you'd really tell the elephant footprint simile, because the Buddha points out that the reasons for thinking someone is a perfectly enlightened Buddha are not the reasons that were given. And we'll see in the end what is the actual reason. I think I already talked about it a little bit last week, but I won't go into detail here. So the Buddha starts to relate how one gains faith in the Buddha. And he's going to go in progression to the point that in the end, the true faith, you might say, in the Buddha's teaching, in the Buddha's enlightenment, comes to one who knows for themselves rather than someone who believes. He's trying to point out that faith is a kind of a fraud or a fake, in a sense. It's like the substitute for knowledge. When you don't know something, the best you can do is have faith in it, and it's not a proper substitute. It's like fake knowledge. Right? So the Buddha would always say, in order to protect the truth, when you believe something, you should say, "I believe this," but you should not say, "I know this." And he said, if someone says they believe something, then they're telling the truth, right? If I say, "I believe the earth is flat," then I'm telling the truth, right? Because if I truly believe that, then I'm telling the truth. But if I say, "I know that the world is flat," then I'm telling a lie. Because unless somehow I have this knowledge that no one else has, that the world is flat, and it's just unknown to everyone else. So, for example. But once you know something, then you don't need faith. This is what he's going to say. And this is how one comes to know. And so he already gave it away in the simile. He says, when the hunter sees the elephant, you know, they don't go by the footprints, they don't go by the markings, they don't go by any of this, because it could all be made by other types of elephant. But when he sees the elephant, that's when he gains the faith, you might say, or that's when he's sure that he's dealing with a bull elephant. So now he's going to start to explain how someone comes to this state of seeing the bull elephant in the Buddha's teaching. So he's already gone through what it is. He talked about how someone realizes how difficult it would be to realize this as a householder, so he leaves the house behind and he goes forth. Having gone forth and taking on the bhikkhu's training and way of life. So it's actually just saying the same thing. Going forth, and what it means by going forth is taking up the training of a bhikkhu. He begins to undertake first morality and then concentration and then wisdom. So we'll see a progression here, and it's quite interesting. To understand what the Buddha meant by morality and the different types of morality. In total, there are four types of morality. And I'm not sure if he's going to go through all of them in detail, but I'll put this, I'm going to put a comment here. Give me a second while I write this. Fourfold morality. One. I'll just do the English. Keeping the precepts. Patimokkha sangvara sila. And then there's guarding the faculties. And then there's pure livelihood. Livelihood. I think I've even spelt that wrong. How do you spell livelihood? Four. Reflecting on or proper use of requisites. I think, not sure if I've even put those in the right order, but anyway, here they are. So we'll see if he's going through all of them here. He may not go into detail with all of them. But he certainly doesn't stop with the keeping the precepts. This is what we're going to start with. Panatipatam pahaya panatipata pativiretto hoti. Nihita dando, nihita satto, lajjidaya panno, sammapana bhuta hitanukampi viharati. Sorry, I memorized this at one point from the Brahmajala Sutta. This is a standard. He's going to go through a standard progression. This sutta is good to study because it gives us the standard progression and it gives a complete progression. So it's going to talk about, and I'm going to make quite clear that this is not necessary for everyone. People will like to point to these suttas. This is the danger. They'll point to these suttas and they'll say, well, the Buddha said we have to do all of this, so we better get cracking. But if you take the point of view that what the Buddha is saying here is all of it is required for everyone, then you're cutting off the chance for anyone who isn't a monk to become enlightened, which of course is not the case, because he's saying someone goes forth. He's not saying this is the only way to come to the truth. A person who is not ordained can become a sotapanna. A person who is ordained but doesn't fulfill all of the practices that are going to be talked about here can become a sotapanna, can even become an arahant. Even a lay person can become an arahant without undertaking all of these practices. So what we're dealing with here is the complete practice, as it would have been in the time of the Buddha. I mean, I would say that even nowadays it's quite difficult, and it would be quite rare to find someone who can actually undertake all of these practices. But because it's a complete practice, it's very good for us to go through it here. Okay, so abandoning the killing of living beings. We're going to start here with keeping the basic precepts, and then he's going to go on and talk about some perhaps more advanced precepts or more detailed precepts. So we're not just talking about the precepts, the 10 precepts. He's actually going to go into quite some detail. So first he starts by talking about the precepts regarding bodily misbehavior. And so here we have not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual intercourse. These are the three bodily precepts. And again, this is the most coarse or most, I guess, coarse or unrefined form of morality. It actually doesn't reach the core of morality because it's just a bunch of rules, conceptual rules. It doesn't actually affect the mind. True morality is what comes from keeping the precepts, for example, and from many other things as well. So it's just giving a list of things, but this is a sort of a framework for people to use. The precepts are a means of beginning to train the mind. So the first rules are stopping certain bodily activities that are going to upset the mind. And then we get on to verbal activities that are going to upset the mind. Lying, lying and gossiping, harsh speech. And gossiping means it actually is divisive speech, I think is what he says here. Well, malicious speech. I believe it would be divisive speech, although I'm not sure of the word pisuna. It might It might mean malicious. Well, it is malicious anyway. It's malicious gossip is the meaning here. So if you read it, it says, does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide people. Amusang bedaya. Imesang bedaya. Bedaya. So to doesn't tell what he has heard here to someone somewhere else in order to divide them from these people. So if someone says something nasty about someone else, you don't go and tell the other person thinking, oh, this will divide them, this will break apart friends, finding ways to break people apart. Harsh speech. Harsh speech means words. Well, there's a lot of meanings here, but the important one is not to be mean, because there are cases of people who say things that are not polite or cultured, but without any intention. So an arahant may actually say something that is uncouth, you might say, whereas a person who is corrupt and unenlightened might speak very, very nicely, very, very courteous and cultured. I've met people like this who are very courteous and cultured and very good with words and able to speak quite well, and yet are capable of the worst sorts of evil with speech. So they have a way of destroying other people with their speech while keeping with a smile on their face and nice words. People who know the diplomats need these sorts of skills, but it's a kind of a court intrigue. You often meet up with people who use words in ways that are deceptive. Use nice words to kill someone. For example, there was an example Mahasi Sayadaw gives of someone. I think it's Mahasi Sayadaw. He says, they used to say, make sure he sleeps well, or something like that. Give him a good sleep. And what it really means is assassinate him. Or, you know, in The Godfather, or that phrase, I may make him an offer he can't refuse, or something like that. And what they really mean is tell him we're going to bump him off if he doesn't do it. So it's not a case of, here the Buddha says pleasing to the air, kannasukha, but to see, for something to be pleasing to the air, it has to actually have a pleasant meaning. There are two parts to any speech. There are the words and then there's the meaning. So you can use nice words that are pleasant in meaning and actually have some insult hidden in them. Where on the other hand, you could use very simple words or coarse words that have kindness and have good intention. So it doesn't necessarily just, it doesn't really have anything to do with the types of words you use. It has to do with the nature of the mind, of course. Gossip here, in fact, gossip is probably a bad word. Gossip I would put with the pisunawaja. But when he talks about abandoning gossip, it's actually useless speech or frivolous speech. And if you read what is meant by gossip, it's not anything to do with what we understand gossip to be anyway. It's so useless speech would be speaking at the wrong time, speaking what is not fact. In this case, I guess it would mean not necessarily lying, but or exaggerating, or speaking without thinking first, so that you actually say something incorrect. Right? A person who's just speaks quickly without thinking, they won't lie, but they'll say things that are incorrect. So if someone asks them, "Did you do this?" they might say, "Yes, yes, I did it," without realizing that they actually didn't. So they didn't mean to lie, but they didn't speak what is a fact, because they didn't think about it thoroughly enough. Speaks on what is good, so a person who is frivolous would speak on what is not good. They would speak on, maybe not speak on what is bad, but they would speak on useless things. So things that are of no use, of no good. They might speak about, what are the rajakatang they speak about. I don't think he's going to go into, in the Brahmajala Sutta, he goes into quite Buddha goes into quite some detail. So he says rajakatang. He doesn't speak about kings, chorakatang. He doesn't speak about thieves or crime. Rajakatang, chorakatang, senakatang. I forget it on the rajakatang, chorakatang, mahamattakatang, ministers, senakatang, yuddhakatang, weapons or armies, rajamahamattakatang, yuddhakatang, senakatang, yuddhakatang, I forget all, but about the beginnings of the universes, or about gossip, or useless, all kinds of useless speech anyway. But if you really want to know about these in detail, it's quite interesting to read the Brahmajala Sutta, which goes into quite some detail. Okay, speak such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. This constitutes the basis of ethical, basic ethical precepts. Now you notice it includes celibacy. So for a monk, these precepts are the basis of the monastic life. They're the core precepts. Now he's going to go into a bunch of others which actually may not really be immoral, but they are against the holy life. So the next one is injuring seeds and plants. And you might think, well, there's nothing really immoral about that, because seeds and plants don't have a mind. There's not really damage being done. On the other hand, you might argue, and I don't know that there's anything to contradict it, that you are causing injury. But at any rate, this goes along with digging in the dirt, digging in the ground, because these are frivolous activities, undisciplined activities. But I suppose the seeds and plants one is interesting and worth more investigation. I was looking it up today, actually, in regards to someone's question, and as to what is the difference between plant and animal life. And plant life is said to be anupadinika. And I just still haven't had time to really go into detail about what exactly is meant by anupadinika. And I have to look it up more. But it basically means what is not clung to by the mind. So there's no mind involved. It's matter that isn't... Anyway, I'm not sure exactly what it means. But different from animal life. So, any practice eating only in one part of the day? Ekabatiko. Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because... Ratu ekabatiko hoti ratu parato. It doesn't mean one part of the day. It means once a day. Ekabatiko means having one meal. So he's really paraphrasing here, and this is sometimes what monks do. I got to be suspicious about why he's using one part of the day, because monks like to say, well, as long as you eat from dawn to noon, you're okay. But Really, the Buddha did tell us to eat once a day. He said, I eat once a day. And somewhere in Majjhima Nikaya number, I forget now, 90 comes to mind. I can't remember. One of the suttas, the Buddha says, two of the suttas, the Buddha says, I eat only one time a day. Why don't you eat? Or you monks should eat only one time a day. I have no problems, physical problems, eating only one meal a day. And the monk said, oh no, we can't do that. And the Buddha said, well then, take what you get from alms, whatever you get one time, cut it, split it up into two portions, eat some in the morning and some later on. Of course, before noon. And the monk says, oh no, we can't do that either. And the Buddha said, well then I can't live with you. And he goes away. And they get all upset and they realize how dumb they were being. And eventually they go and apologize. But it's quite clear that the Buddha said, only eat once a day. So in one part of the day is quite misleading. Well, it's a little bit misleading anyway. But the point is to eat only once. Or have only one meal. Now, if you want to split the meal up into two parts, the point being, don't go and find a second meal. Don't go and seek out food a second time, or as they do nowadays, wait for people to come in the morning and then wait for people to come in the daytime, because they want two different meals. It should be one set of food anyway. It's kind of an exception that you can split it up, but it's still one set of food. So not eating at night or outside the proper time. Abstains from dancing, singing, music, and theatrical shows. What's wrong with these things? The Buddha said dancing is a form of insanity in the Arya Vinaya. So for one intent on enlightenment, dancing is considered a form of insanity. Singing is considered a form of lamentation or wailing. Pointing out the frivolity or the silliness of these things. Music is just sound, no? Theatrical show is just illusion. He abstains from wearing garlands, smartening himself with scents, and embellishing himself with unguents. High and large couches. So actually, if you look at all of these, they're not any of them really immoral, right? Because theoretically, you could dance without... you could probably dance mindfully. No, you could even sing mindfully, theoretically. But because these things are so tightly bound up with our cravings, we really have to give them up. You can theoretically do them mindfully, but not in practice, not easily. Wearing garlands, sure, you could wear garlands mindfully. But when you're engaged, when you're into wearing garlands, you don't be very mindful. You're not very mindful. So all of these, accepting men and women slaves, women and girls, some of these might seem pretty obvious. Raw grain, raw meat, women and girls, that's pretty obvious for a monk. But the thing is, you have to look in the context. Look at the context. The Buddha's talking about ascetics in the time in this time in ancient India. And at that time, there were ascetics who actually engaged in this kind of thing. In fact, nowadays, you'll even see monks engaging in some of these things. Monks who accept raw grain. Monks who accept rice and just, you know, keep it and have someone cook it for them. And so it's surprising to them how the Buddha said here that monks are not allowed to accept raw grain, raw food. This is leading to greed, leading to accumulation. Sure, you can do it. I mean, ordinary people do it all the time and they're able to practice and, you know, even become enlightened. But given the danger involved in it and the tendency that it brings towards contentment with complacency and so on. You know, when you have food stored up, you become complacent and you can become lazy and you can become attached. Obviously, you very easily become attached to the food. Tomorrow I'm going to eat this, tonight I'm going to eat that. being able to pick and choose what you eat. Abstains from accepting women and girls. That's pretty obvious, but in the time of the Buddha there were religious people who did have women and girls attending on them. And they had, like Gandhi is maybe an example of, apparently Gandhi had several women on his in his ashram. And the stories go, whether they're true or not, the stories go that he actually would sleep with these women, but not have sex with them, because he was testing himself. This is what I read somewhere. So I hope it's true and I'm not telling a fib, but apparently he would sleep with these young girls in order to test his vow of chastity. And so, like, actually kind of interesting sort of practice. But it can only lead to repression. I don't see how it can actually be an effective means. Unless you have a really... Well, Gandhi was pretty strong, no? Whatever. It's an interesting idea. But in the time of the Buddha, there would be ascetics who said, well, as long as you don't sleep with them, you can have them massage you and you can play games with them and so on and whatever. Or even maybe they did sleep with them and that wasn't part of their practice. You even hear about this, about how monks will often have women and they're only pretending to be monks and they actually have women. And I've heard stories about actually hiring prostitutes and so on. So this kind of thing exists. You know, we're not supposed to talk about these things, but actually it's not against the rules, and it's important for us to talk about this because we put ourselves on the right side of the fence. You know, just because you're in robes doesn't mean you're a real monk. And I don't, as monks, we don't associate ourselves with someone who is just in robes. We associate ourselves with people who fit the bill in suttas like this. So if someone is not keeping these, we should be clear that these people are not monks. They're not practicing the Buddha's teaching. He abstains from accepting all of these things more and more, lots and lots of stuff. And the last one, he abstains from cheating, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. He abstains from wounding, murdering, buying, brigandage, plunder, and violence. Well, it's kind of assumed based on the earlier precepts, but here is something we don't hear about often, how the Buddha actually did mention violence, because we can always say, well, as long as you don't kill things, violence isn't in one of the precepts, so you can get in a fight and beat someone up. But nope, it's here in the rules as well. And this, I think, applies for lay people as well. I suppose not. I mean, that's kind of the key of the five precepts, that the Buddha didn't expect his lay followers to be totally pure and moral, and they might actually get in fights and beat each other up. But the point was, whatever you do, don't kill someone, because that you can't say sorry about. That doesn't heal. It's a scar that stays in your mind for a long, long time. You can't give the life back, for example. Okay, that's the first one. The next one. Here we are going to get into the fourth one that I mentioned above, which is Paccaya Paccavekana Sila, which is the reflection on using alms, or using requisites. So there are four requisites. There are the robes, the food, and then there's the dwelling, and then the medicines. He only mentions two here, right? He goes, content with robes to protect his body and alms food to maintain his stomach. Wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. This is a beautiful quote, actually, no? Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. So too a monk goes with only robes and bowl as his wings, or her wings. And here he starts to give the point of morality. So he says, So imina ariyena sila kandena samanagato, with this noble form of aggregate of virtue, all of these types of virtue, anjatang anavajja sukhang patisamvedeti. So he experienced a unadulterated or blameless form of bliss. This is the benefit of morality. And it's an important point when we talk about happiness and when we talk about morality. So now we know what morality is for, but we also know that there are two types of happiness. The anavajja sukha and vajja sukha. Or avajja, is it avajja sukha? Sukha that has happiness that is blameable. And what kind of happiness is that? Well, there are two kinds of happiness in the Abhidhamma. There's the happiness that is associated with greed, with tanha, and then there's the happiness associated with wholesomeness. So when a person does a wholesome deed, like when you give a gift to someone, you feel happy about it. And when a person keeps morality, they feel happy about it. It's actually very true. When a person who has been immoral before begins to keep these precepts, they feel such a great sort of bliss and coolness in the mind. They can verify this sort of thing. A person who is engaged in immorality has great heat and confusion in their mind. And when they stop doing all of those things, they become cool and peaceful in the mind, happy, blissful, in fact. And this has to do with what comes next, has to do with concentration. And this is fortifying a person's concentration. Even just keeping these rules is like putting down fence posts. So maybe even making a fence. You have this fence, and it keeps you from going outside of that. When you get to the boundary, you say, oh, there's the fence, and you turn around and come back. So you don't do all sorts of things, and it slowly trains your mind, even just a bunch of precepts. So that's, and also the second one was using the requisites. So using the requisites, just to go back a bit, explaining about this, it means anything that you have to use, using it for the right reasons. So, point being, if a person has clothing and it's enough to cover their body, but then they still go out and buy clothing to be beautiful or to be attractive or, you know, to... Because even just because they like clothing, you know? Some people like to buy clothing. Always buying some new kind of clothing, something that they can look in the mirror at. And these big mirrors in their rooms, so we can look at them. That's not reflecting. That's using clothing for not for its purpose. Here, but mostly you hear meditators, they go to the used clothing stores and buy very cheap clothing, which is often of better quality in terms of the material and the durability than the new clothing that you buy for lots and lots of money with brand names and so on. And with food as well. Food is something that we have to reflect on. We should think of it as medicine. So the Buddha said the alms bowl should be considered a medicine pan. You mix up, because in the olden days they would mix up herbal medicine by themselves and mix it up in a pan. And so he said, that's how you should see the alms bowl. It's a medicine pan, and you mix all the food up, you mix all the medicine up in it, which is your food. And you eat it like medicine. As opposed to in ordinary life, we're always thinking about a restaurant we can go out to, or tonight what will we have? Tonight we'll have this food or that food, right? There are even families who every day they have a different meal, and it's planned out. Today is steak night, or today is, and we have food like steaks and hamburgers, all designed to please our taste buds and actually bring more and more attachment. Right? and not certainly not make you happier as an individual. This is the kind of bliss that is blamable, because it leads to, it's a bliss that is caught up in addiction. It's called amisa sukha, meaning it has an object. There's two kinds of sukha, niramisa sukha and amisa sukha. Amisa sukha has an object. So as long as you get that object, you have happiness. But when you don't have the object, you're unhappy. And so on. So everything we use, our shelter should be used just as the Buddha said, to give us seclusion so we can actually practice meditation, but to keep away bugs and to keep away snakes and scorpions and so on. And medicine should be used only for the purpose of overcoming illness. So we shouldn't just, when we feel pain, take a painkiller, or when we're weak, we have a stimulant, or people who take multivitamins, and all this, that is just for the purpose of bringing strength. When you feel weak, you think, oh, I need more food like this, or I need food to get strong, or so on. Of course, for lay people, some of this is necessary, you know. Clothes, you might need beautiful clothes for work, or clean clothes, or special clothes. You might need more food than a monk, because you have to work. You have some kind of hard work, and you might need a big house, or at least a small house. But you might need a house in order to keep your computer or whatever it is that you work with, in order to keep your family or however, a garage for your car and so on, because you have a car that you need to work with. So the point being, here we're talking about the ultimate sort of lifestyle, which is the lifestyle of a monk, someone who is totally just the bare minimum. But you can apply this in life as well. This is one rule that is easily applied in life, to an ordinary life. So you use things for their purpose, not getting caught up in using them out of greed. This is a kind of morality, is being careful with the things that you use. It's the second type of morality. The third type is, we come to next, so chakuna rupang diswa na nimittagaha na nimittagahi hoti nanu byanjanagahi. So he doesn't cling to the, or he doesn't grasp the signs or features. What does this mean? It should be quite clear. The point is, when you see something, the truth of it is that it's form, right? It's a picture that actually you put together in the mind. So when you see a person, it's actually being put together in your mind. So to grasp the nimitta, and it doesn't necessarily mean greed. It's not quite talking about that. It means not paying attention to, not. It's that sense of the word grasp. So when we say get a grasp of a concept or so on, when someone's explaining something, you can grasp what they're saying. This is what is being meant here. So the Buddha is saying we should strive to not grasp the particulars or the concepts involved. So when you see something, it should be just seeing. As the Buddha said, ditte ditta mattang bhavisati. This is what he taught Bahiya, this very famous Bahiya Sutta. Bahiya was a person who thought he was enlightened. Well, it's a long story, but he became shipwrecked and lost all his belongings. And so he was naked, and he just decided to wear the, or he wanted to go beg, so he put this some kind of sort of wood, a piece of wood over his private parts. In the front, I guess. And so he walked on alms round like that. And people thought, oh, he must be enlightened. And so they gave him lots of food. And also they wanted to give him cloth. And he refused it. Because he thought, oh, they think I'm enlightened, so they give me food. He thought, if I start to wear clothes, then they won't give me food. So eventually he started to think, maybe I am enlightened. Here I am, this special person. And he started to act like it. Started to teach people whatever. And then he realized his friend came. One of his friends from a past life was born in the god realms. And so this god came down at night and said, you're not an arahant. Go find the Buddha. Then you'll become an arahant. So he went to find the Buddha, and the Buddha said to him, Dite ditta matang bhavisati. When you see, let it just be seeing. Sutte sutta matang bhavisati. When seeing will just be seeing. Train yourself thus. Seeing will just be seeing. What is seen will just be what is seen. You won't grasp the particulars. So you can find yourself doing this when you meditate. You say to yourself, seeing, seeing, or even hearing, hearing. You can try it now when you're listening to my talk. Start looking at the sound and say to yourself, hearing, hearing. And you can actually hear that it's just sound. And your mind shifts into another gear where suddenly you're just aware of sound. And you know that the sound is arising and ceasing. This experience, if you try it now, just saying hearing, hearing, this experience, that what you experience, the shift, that's the arising of mindfulness. Because as long as you're listening to the meaning of the words and thinking about them and trying to grasp them, there's no intense mindfulness, or there's no meditative mindfulness in the mind, even though it might arise from moment to moment. It's not continuous. So what you experience then, when you're actually aware of the sound arising and ceasing, this is mindfulness. And it begins to teach the mind the nature of reality, because that's the observation of reality at that moment. When the mind starts to observe reality, it sees it arising and ceasing, and it breaks up the idea of self. It starts to understand that reality is moment to moment. Whereas ordinarily you get the concept in your mind of, this is me talking. This is some monk or some guy who lives off in Sri Lanka. And you start to think about, this is the Buddha's teaching and so on. So you get all these concepts arising. Maybe you even have judgments, like you like what is being said or you don't like what is being said. And so on. This all disappears when you just say to yourself, hearing, hearing, and focus on the sound. And so this is what the Buddha says, exactly what he says. Since, if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. So you can see that actually it's a form of meditation. Morality is actually meditation. When we talk about meditation, the first part of meditation is morality. You don't have concentration yet. But the development of concentration is called morality. Morality is that which leads to concentration, to focus the mind. And this is one very important way of focusing the mind. I think if we look back up at the top, I'm just going to back up. If we go back up to where it talks about injuring seeds and plants and eating only in one part of the day, probably we can stretch that, especially the ending part. Yes, at the end he says, abstains from going on errands and running messages, abstains from buying and selling, abstains from false weights, and so on. This is right livelihood. So this is an ascetic who has given up wrong livelihood, like going on errands, doing work for ordinary lay people, working in ways that are, you know, apart from teaching the Dhamma. So working in a worldly sense, for the hopes of getting, in the hopes of getting gain, working to get something more than the bare minimum. You feel like, eh, the food I get isn't rich enough, the food I get isn't good enough. What if I were to run errands for people? If I do this for these people, they'll love me, and then they'll feel obliged to give me good food and good robes and so on. And then I'll get what I want. So people think like that. Ascetics will think like this. This is, so this is the third of the ones I mentioned. So actually he does go through all four if you look at it. What is being taught here is first the keeping the precepts, second having right pure livelihood, third reflecting on the use of the requisites, and fourth guarding the faculties. So he's got a different order than I put up there, but these are the four. And then what? Now we get on to meditation proper. You might say that last one was pretty meditative, and it is certainly a part of the meditation. But now we're actually getting into really the practice of the Satipatthana. This is actually a different way of describing the path, because it's not talking about concentration specifically, it's talking about mindfulness. This is And this is something you will see elsewhere. If you look in the Satipatthana Samyutta, for example, the Buddha would talk about morality. When a person has morality and then develops the Satipatthana, these are the types of the basic practices, to have morality and then practice Satipatthana. This will develop. Anyway, the next section will be talking about concentration, so it will come up. But this is just it's kind of like a header, because obviously one would have to be mindful of the feelings, one would have to be mindful of the mind and mindful of the dhammas, mindful of all things that arose. And so we can extrapolate on what the Buddha says here. He says, Ambikante, Patikante, going forward and backward. This is, means when he's doing walking meditation. When a person does walking meditation back and forth, they're mindful of that. Alokite, Vilokite, when looking ahead and looking away, when turning their head and looking here and looking there. Saminjite, Pasarite, when flexing or extending their arms. Say, knowing yourself, extending, when you flex, say, flexing. When one wearing the robes, carrying the outer robe, sanghati patajivaradharane, carrying the robe and bowls and the sanghati, the outer robe, sampajanakari hoti. I like full awareness. I think it's a good translation here. Sam could mean full, and pajana means awareness or knowledge. Sampajanakari, he's one who acts in full awareness or brings about full awareness. Asite, pite, kaite, saite, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. So when tasting food, we have our meditators. When chewing, we have... When meditators eat here, when you come to practice at our meditation center, we actually have you. We're gathering the food with your fingers as we eat with our hands, no? Gathering. When you raise the hand, raising. When you open your mouth, opening. When you place the food in your mouth, placing. When you close your mouth, closing. When you lower your hand, lowering. When you chew the food, chewing. When you taste the food, tasting. When you swallow the food, swallowing. We actually have people meditate like this. After a few days, once they get into it. There was a monk who once gave a talk, and he explained how he said when he was meditating, his teacher asked him, how were you mindful today? He said, oh, I was mindful on the toilet. I was saying, basically saying crapping, but in Thai he was saying it, so it's dumping, basically. Evacuating, I think, would be a translation. And the teacher kind of laughed at him and said, oh, that, how stupid is that? How stupid are you? Something like that. And then he was all confused, and he went back and looked at the Satipatthana Sutta, and he saw this passage where it actually says, where is it? Uchara pasava kamme. When urinating and defecating, in the act of urinating or defecating, one is sampajanakari hoti. So if anyone tells you that meditation has to be done on a sitting mat, now you know this is not true. Meditation can be done urinating and defecating. It's a shocker, no? Gate tite nisine sute cha karite. Walking, standing, sitting, listening. Right? Listening. No, sute, sorry. Sute means falling asleep. Cha karite, waking up. So meditators are instructed to, when falling asleep, be mindful rising, falling, and some meditators can actually know when they're falling asleep. Was it on the rising or was it on the falling? And when you're waking up, we have meditators say lying, or waking, or so on. When you know that you're waking up. When talking, one is mindful. So meditators always ask me, how can you talk and be mindful? And it's quite, I've gotten into several arguments because people don't believe. They say, that's impossible. I don't believe that. It's sad, really, to be so closed-minded, because you can be mindful and talk at the same time. You can be aware of the movements of the mouth. The brain actually takes care of most of the talking. The brain is trained to talk. The thought that you're going to say just takes a moment, and then the brain starts to go into action and starts to say it. And that's all pretty automatic. You don't have to be there moving your lips. See, we think we're moving our lips when we talk, but actually the brain is doing most of the work, and it's all really automatic. And there's only certain moments where there arises a thought. Vitaka vichara, this creates the verbal, physical manifestation, which is automatic. So even when I'm talking now, I can be mindful. I can give rise to moments of mindfulness. Interspersed with moments of thinking of what to say next. And when listening, of course, I already mentioned this, when you're listening, you're mindful of the sound. Sutte suttamattang. So these, you might consider, at least in this sutta, that this is the requisite preliminaries. Preliminary sorts of behavior. This is the attitude, a description of the attitude a monk should have, or the lifestyle a monk should have. So the morality and the deportment, you might say, that one should be meditative all the time and moral. So mindful and morality. Here's the aggregate of noble virtue, the restraint of the faculties, and mindfulness and full awareness. Sati sampajan, janya, sati sampajanya. And so what to do when one is trained in this way? One begins to apply oneself to the development of higher things. Development of realization of the truth. And he gives some examples of places: forest, the root of a tree, mountain, a ravine, a hillside, cave, charnel ground. This is like a cemetery or a place where they throw dead people. Yeah. Jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. Here's where we start to get into the practice of samatha meditation. So what we're going to see is that, as I said, this is the complete path. And I'm only mentioning this not to try to stir things up, but for those of you who are wondering, you know, why aren't we practicing a lot of what comes next, like remembering past lives or reading people's minds or so on, or even the bliss that comes from the jhanas. What you'll find in modern day vipassana meditation, which is solely for the purpose of getting to the final part, is that it's much streamlined. So you'll still be able to follow this paragraph. This paragraph is quite clearly still in the realm of what might be called vipassana meditation, but what comes next, in the next paragraph, which is going to, it has to be understood in the right way. So hopefully I can do this. I'll try to go through it, because obviously the first paragraph, there's no contention. Everyone is practicing these things. So returning from alms round, one sits down, sets the body erect, and sets mindfulness before themselves. And this is based on what is above and based on the four satipatthana. So we're talking about mindfulness, sati. We are obviously going to be, the meaning is practice of the four satipatthana. So when there's this state or that state, one is aware of it as it is. And this is how, so in this sense, this is very much how we are practicing when we practice what we call vipassana. And the point that the Buddha establishes here is that the idea of practicing the four satipatthana is for the purpose of overcoming the five hindrances. So where do we find the hindrances? Starting here, we're dealing with abandoning the five hindrances. You'll see he says abandoning this, abandoning that. What he's actually talking about here is the five hindrances. These five are the five hindrances. And this comes even from meditating on the hindrances. As the Buddha said, when the hindrance is present, he knows it's present, aware of the covetousness, meditating on it, so that there doesn't arise attachment to it and views about it as being me and mine and so on. And then eventually it disappears, it recedes, it is discarded for being useless and a cause of stress and suffering. But the next paragraph, even the next paragraph, can still be understood as being relating to an ordinary practice of vipassana meditation. So what happens when one abandons the five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, panyaya dubalikarane, they render impotent, or they create difficulty for wisdom, weaken wisdom, you find. Take the strength out of wisdom. Yeah, weaken is a very good translation. Becomes quite secluded from sensual pleasure. So at this time, the mind is no longer thinking about pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, or feelings. One enters into the first jhana. And the first jhana The first jhana is considered to be when the meditator first experiences the bliss of a quiet mind, bliss of freedom from the hindrances. And this comes to everyone who practices. If you practice correctly, every meditator who comes through here comes to this point where their mind becomes pure and tranquilized, and the hindrances have disappeared. So they enter into what could be called the first jhana. Now, the problem is that people make a really big deal out of this and think of it as some no-no, it's some special state that is fixed, you know, and lasts for hours, and you don't think of anything, and your mind is like blissed out, no? But actually, the first jhana just means where the mind is free from the five hindrances. When the five hindrances are gone, one enters into the first jhana. Now, it's upon entering the first jhana that the paths diverge, because it's only the first jhana that is necessary. In fact, the commentaries say not even jhana proper is necessary. What is necessary is that moment, the very first moment when the hindrances are suppressed. Because the jhana, of course, doesn't do away with the hindrances, it only suppresses them. So at the moment of the entering into the jhana, the hindrances are suppressed. And that's the moment that's the most important. Everything from then on is, as the Buddha says, he says elsewhere, it's an abiding in happiness. So that happiness can lead two ways. It can lead towards what we're going to see next, the development of all sorts of wonderful and mystical experience, magical experiences. Or it can go directly towards vipassana. And so you can skip all the rest of the stuff. And for sure you can skip all the rest of the stuff. There is no need to gain magical powers. There's no need to go to the arupa jhanas. But everyone has to come to at least the first jhana or thereabouts. And let's just say the first jhana, because I don't want to get into controversy or, you know, technicality. But we're talking about when the five hindrances are suppressed. That's all that needs to be done. The idea of going into the second, third, fourth jhanas. You know, in fact, you could, depending on how you interpret these, you could say that vipassana meditators go through all four of these, because a person who reaches sankharupeka jnana has very much the same characteristics of someone who enters into the fourth jhana. And what you'll see here, down at the bottom, the Buddha says, if we skip down here to the fourth jhana, so this first paragraph was the first jhana. We skip down to the fourth jhana, we see purity of mindfulness due to equanimity, which sounds very much like vipassana, no? Because it must mean mindful of something. But what we're going to see next is actually it's probably not vipassana. It's probably not mindful of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. It's probably mindful of the breath, for example, or mindfulness of some sort of concept, which is what we're going to in regards to the arupa jhanas. Let's see. He doesn't even go into the arupa jhanas, or does he? We're going to talk about... No, you can see he's not even mentioning the arupa jhanas, unless I'm missing something here. That's too bad. I wanted to explain the arupa jhanas. But we won't. Anyway... But we should skip back up and talk about what the Buddha has to say about these jhanas. So he says, This is a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. So the Buddha was able to point out a practice that that is profound and is meaningful, just like a bull elephant is capable of scraping or making big footprints or scraping the trunks of trees or so on, something marked by the Tathagata. But the power of this simile points something out here, because if you look back up at the simile, what did the Buddha say about these sorts of things? He said, well, the hunter knows that even people who are not enlightened, even elephants that are not the great bull elephant can make these marks. And so really what we should understand the Buddha to be saying here is that even unenlightened beings like Ulara and Alara and Udaka, the Buddha's two teachers who taught him these sorts of things, or the Bodhisattva when he was 5 years old, and or, no, 5 years when he was very, very young, had this experience, even though he was unenlightened. So even though a person, when they practice here, they often will say, and they will often get caught up in faith and say, oh, the Buddha must be enlightened. This is what happens when people come to practice. When they get to this point, they will have such faith in what they're doing. This is called saddha. It's mentioned as one of the 10 upakilesa, because it's all right for practicing samatha, for gaining these powers, magical powers and power of mind, but it's no good for vipassana, because it'll get you stuck. It will make you complacent. It will stop you from seeing things as they are. You begin to have faith in the Buddha, faith in yourself. You think you're enlightened, and you have such faith in your teacher, and you have faith in your ability to teach others, and you want to go back home and spread the teaching. Wow, all of my friends have to practice this. My family has to practice this. And you go on what they call a Buddhist jihad. This is what one of the monks here calls it. And go back home and try to convert everyone and force everyone to convert. And so for this reason, for the reason that these are not, oh sorry, so these are good things that come, but they are not, anyone can have these things. It's not enlightenment. And in fact, people who are not even following the Buddha's teaching can have these experiences, can have even far more profound, many of the other experiences we're going to mention. So it's a sign that the Buddha is teaching something good, but it's not a sign that the Buddha is fully enlightened. So he says, a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. They don't come to a certainty. It isn't final. Their knowledge isn't final. Nittang, they don't come to the conclusion. Nittang means ending or conclusion. Same with the second jhana, same with the third jhana, and same with the fourth jhana. So these are good things, and they're a sign that the Buddha is teaching something. It's a sign, but a skilled practitioner would not take this to mean, and would certainly not take this to mean that oneself was enlightened. This is the danger. When these good things come, people tend to think that they're enlightened, and especially with the next paragraph. The next paragraph having to do with the magical powers. Because when the mind is concentrated, when the mind is purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, then one begins to develop magical powers. And he said that you see in brackets there as sutta number 4. I can't remember which one is sutta number 4. Must be Majjhima Nikaya number 4. Would it be, or is it this number 4 in this vagga? I'm not sure. But it's going back to the basic description of the various types of magical powers. No, sorry, the various types of memory of past lives. So for all those people who are criticizing me and saying, oh, how can you tell people that meditation leads to magical powers? Well, here you have it. Didn't come up with it myself, certainly not. The Buddha talked all about it. He said, this is a footprint of the Tathagata. It comes hand in part and parcel with the Buddha's teaching. Because many people, if they practice to the full extent of meditation, and as I said, it puts everything in context. This is the Buddha's lion's roar. It's him saying, explaining how his teaching goes beyond all of this. How even these great things are not enough. You know, let alone when you see, as he said, as the wanderer said, how he understood the Buddha to be enlightened was simply because of what other people thought of the Buddha. So the Buddha said, even when someone comes and remembers their past lives based on the Buddha's teaching, they still shouldn't think, oh, this means the Buddha's enlightened. They still shouldn't come to the conclusion even for that reason, let alone all the other reasons that were given. And then he goes on to direct it to the knowledge of passing away and the reappearance of beings. With the divine eye, no? So he is able to see beings arising and passing away, being born and dying according to their karma. Now, these two people often will say that these are not the Buddha's teaching and they don't have anything to do with the Buddha's teaching, but there is an important point here. What's great about remembering your past lives and seeing things far away, or being able to see all sorts of things that are going on in the world, which are basically these two knowledges. This is actually the Tivijja. Let's put a comment here, because this is starting the three knowledges. And these are actually the three knowledges that the Buddha gained on the night of his enlightenment. The great thing about these, and this is why some people say that these are necessary, which of course they're not, the reason they'll say that they're necessary is because of how great they are in teaching you the nature of samsara. As the Buddha says, he sees the fortunate and unfortunate, the fair, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions, which is a really important realization. But of course, this realization doesn't require past lives or the divine eye. It's something that we can see even here and now when we watch people and we see how beings become defiled based on their evil actions and so on. But the third vijja, the third knowledge here, this is where we start to go from the point of having faith to having knowledge, because this is where knowledge of Nibbana comes. Okay, so when we look at this paragraph, his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. He directs it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. And this is a very brief description of what I would say actually takes a little bit more explanation. But, of course, in the time of the Buddha, you can just think of this as being the summary. Because he's not actually going to Janusoni is not actually going to become enlightened, but it's the Buddha explaining in brief, which is quite useful because then it opens the door. It says, well, this is what I teach. If you want to come and try it, you can learn about it. But the key here is in the words, this is suffering. We have to see, understand what is being meant there, because we shouldn't look at this and just say, oh yes, that's philosophy or that's the Buddhist philosophy. He's actually saying this person comes and learns about suffering. So at this point it can no longer be samatha. At this point the person is now practicing vipassana. We're using samatha as the basis. They've come all the way to back to where they started, which is to focus on the physical and mental realities that are arising and ceasing, which are the truth of suffering. What is the truth of suffering? We learned in the first sutta. It's the body and the mind, basically. And all of our experiences, these are the truth of suffering that arise and cease moment to moment. And so, going through the Four Noble Truths, giving up the origin of suffering and realizing the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So this is a description of the practice of vipassana all the way up to maggajnana, and all the way up to palajnana, where the mind enters into nibbana. So what's curious here is that the Buddha says even at the experience of nibbana, the noble disciple has not yet come to the conclusion that he is fully enlightened. And that's, I guess, technically... The technical answer you'd have to give is that even at the moment of Nibbana, obviously, it's true that he doesn't actually have in his mind any idea that the Buddha is enlightened, because at that moment there's only the experience of Nibbana. So this is going all the way up to the 15th stage of Vipassana Jnana, for those of you who understand these things or know about the Jnanas. What has happened is he started out. The meditator started, the monk started out looking at the five aggregates, understanding that they're impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable, to the point where the mind became clear and understood this to be the reality of life, to understand this is the truth, so the truth of suffering. Therefore, giving up craving for it and letting go. And by giving up craving and letting go, that's the path and therefore the cessation. But all that time, there wasn't yet the realization. Now, even up to the moment, and this is the Buddha being quite exact here, even at the moment of realizing Nibbana, there can be no knowledge that the Buddha is enlightened. And he says, he is in the process of coming to this conclusion, obviously, because at this moment he's in Nibbana. There's the cessation of suffering. So, but then what happens? Then he comes out, and this is Paccavekana Jnana, the 16th stage of knowledge. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, being, and ignorance. These are the asava. So the asava, the taints, or the things which lead to defilement, or things which lead to bad karma, sorry, things which lead to lead one to proliferate or diverse, make more out of things than they actually are, to bring about judgment, mental activity. And so then there arises the knowledge. Vijaso jitang vimutta swing vimutta miti vimuttang iti jnanang hoti. There is the knowledge, it is liberated. I don't know about that grammar and I don't really understand this myself, so. Anyway, I guess you could say it is liberated. It's an interesting way of putting it. Because what is liberated? When the mind is liberated, no? No, not convinced. You could say the mind is liberated, maybe. He understands thus, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done, you can notice this is a different translator than the last suttas. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he goes more according to what I would use. What had to be done has been done. At the very least, it should be what is to be done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And here he says, this too, Brahman, is a footprint, something scraped. But this is actually not just something that is scraped by the Tathagata. This is seeing the truth, seeing the Dhamma. And as the Buddha said, yo dhammang pasati, so mang pasati. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. Yo dhammang pasati, so tathagatang pasati. Whoever sees the truth sees me, sees the Tathagata. And so it's at this point, at the 16th stage of knowledge, that one comes to. And in fact, this is even further than that. This is not just Sotapanna. This is the Arahant. And it's with the Arahant, the attainment of Arahantship, that the simile is complete. That one comes to the conclusion, has come to the conclusion. So they don't even have to think it, but there is the knowledge in their mind that the Blessed One is enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed and the Sangha is practicing in a good way, because they realize it for themselves. And so the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in detail. And the last paragraph is just the conclusion that we see in so many of the suttas. And so it's a bit suspicious as to whether each and every person who heard the Buddha's teaching actually said exactly the same thing, because so many of them seem to have said exactly the same thing. It may simply be that, well, this what they said isn't really so important, so they, rather than remembering it, they just kind of assumed that this is what they said. Because it's not really important. Nobody really cares what they said. They must have loved what the Buddha said, because the Buddha was really clever and wise and so on. So we say, well, said something like this. And the basis of it is that the Buddha made very clear something that was unclear. And they have such faith in the Buddha that they ask permission to become a lay follower, an upasaka. And that's what the Brahmin Janusoni did. And there we have completed the study of the Chulapatipadokama Sutta.